This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get a closer look at the latest U.S. negotiations with Iran and Israel's demand to dismantle Iran's entire nuclear energy program.
Richard Becker, the Western Regional Coordinator of ACT Now to Stop War and End Racism, details what is at stake. We then speak with Nadia Ben-Youssef, the Advocacy Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, about a new report submitted by four human rights groups denouncing the accelerated disintegration of democracy in the U.S.
The report is entitled Entrenching Authoritarianism, Expanding the Terrorism Framework and the Infrastructure of Surveillance to Repress Expression and Stifle Dissent.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. In 2015, the United States and Iran negotiated an agreement designed to allow Iran to develop peaceful uses of nuclear energy, but not nuclear weapons. That agreement was terminated in 2018 during Trump's first administration, and sanctions on Iran were reimposed, sanctions that have proven to be very damaging to Iran's financial well-being. Now the Trump administration has said his administration is prepared to enter into a new nuclear non-proliferation agreement with Iran. But at the recent conclusion of what was the third round of U.S.-Iran negotiations on the issue, negotiations that appear to have gathered some good momentum, Israel's Netanyahu has demanded that even Iran's nuclear program for peaceful uses be dismantled, something Iran has steadfastly refused to consider. Will Israel be successful in opposing Iran's development of a nuclear program, even if it is limited to peaceful uses? If Iran will not agree to give up its peaceful uses of nuclear energy, is a war between Israel and Iran inevitable? Meanwhile, the back-and-forth attacks by Israel on Iran and Iran on Israel continue. Indeed, just last week, the Houthis, an Iran proxy, dropped a missile near Iran's Ben Gurion airport, and already Israel has responded. All of this raises the question, would the Trump administration join Israel if it waged war on Iran, perhaps including its nuclear facilities? And how would other Mideastern nations respond if war did break out between Israel and Iran, and perhaps with the United States fighting alongside of Israel? Well, to help us answer these thorny issues and others, we're fortunate to have as our guest today Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of The Answer, ACT Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition, and the author of Palestine, Israel and the U.S. Empire, and of the book The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Richard Becker, a warm, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Nice to be on.
Richard, inasmuch as Israel and Iran have, well, each been conducting military attacks on the other over time, isn't it the case that Israel and Iran have, in effect, been at war for some time now? I mean, not a full-blown war, but acts of war have been engaged in back and forth, have they not?
Yes, and it's really been going on for a long time. And most of the war, for most of that time, which really amounts to the last 20, 25 years, it's been Israel carrying out targeted assassinations, for one thing, against scientists and key people in Iran's nuclear project. And then, of course, what we've seen in recent months is an escalation of actual combat between Iran and Israel, although that's not taking place, and the United States, of course, but that's not taking place right at the moment. But it has been, it's been a really a war that has been accompanied with another form of warfare, which is the sanctions that have inflicted a great deal of pain on Iran. Iran is not a small country, but it's still a country that's dependent on trade for many necessities of life. So that form of warfare that's been going on, really directed by the U.S., but with Israel taking part and with other U.S. allies taking part, that amounts to war against Iran.
Richard, if a full-fledged war does break out between Iran and Israel, which Arab nations, if any, are apt to come to Iran's defense, and which, if any, are apt to come to Israel's defense?
Well, I think that what we would see is that there would be other forces who are part of what's called the Axis of Resistance would very likely join in on a war on Iran's side if Israel attacks Iran. What Arab countries would come to Israel? Well, Israel has through the Abraham Accords, has brought in to its orbit other countries in the Arab world, and Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, and others. But I don't know if any of them could take the risk, the chance of actually participating in a war against Iran on the side of Israel. That would put them all in a precarious position, all those governments, because all of those governments are at odds with their own population, and their own population regards their governments with skepticism, to say the least, and outright opposition more commonly.
You know, Richard, there have been, as I mentioned during the introduction, there have been negotiations going on again between Iran and the United States over what they had before, whereby they could develop peaceful uses of nuclear weapons, although, as I said, Israel even objects to that. But it raises the question, doesn't it? I mean, under such an agreement, if Iran and the United States did reach an agreement currently, they'd be in a situation where Iran could develop its nuclear program for peaceful means, but not for a bomb. I mean, there are 9 other nations in the world already who have nuclear weapons. Indeed, Israel is one of them. Doesn't Iran have as much right as any other country to have nuclear weapons at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, this idea that somehow Israel and the United States can say who does and who does not have nuclear weapons, I mean, it's colonial. It's a colonial approach to Iran, and Iran mm-hmm. has a long and bitter history of colonialism, and they're not going to go for that. Okay. We hear the news and see the news, and it's all over the news, that the U.S., the Trump administration, perhaps it appears going around its own military, as around its own Defense Department, has reached an agreement with the Ansar Allah, often called Houthis, the government of most of Yemen, that has been at war with the State of Israel and has been supporting the Palestinians, that they've reached an agreement to stop firing at each other. The Houthis, the Ansar Allah government, says it will not attack U.S. ships any longer, and the U.S. says it will not carry out airstrikes against Yemen. Now, this is very new, and we don't know if it's going to hold up. The news, the international news, is saying that the Iranian government encouraged the Ansar Allah government to make this agreement with the U.S., which may mean that there's some further negotiations that are underway. You know, these are things we find out about after the fact, not while the negotiations are actually happening, just as has just happened. But this is a very startling development, because there's much to it, and it's too soon to try to be exhaustive. But the agreement does not cover Israel. The government in Yemen, the Ansar Allah government, says it's going to continue until the war against Gaza, against the Palestinians in Gaza, comes to an end. And they said, the Ansar Allah government says it's going to continue to support the Palestinians until the war against them ends, Israel's war against them ends, even if it means going to Judgment Day. That's the quote. Also, we see in some of the coverage of this very startling development, and as I said, startling not just to the general public, but according to the reports in the New York Times, the Pentagon, the Defense Department, didn't know that this agreement had been reached. And one of the other factors involved in it, and I think this is very important from seeing things in the overall view, is that there's been complaints from within the administration and within the military that they're using so much in the way of munitions against Yemen that it's endangering, and again, this is a quote, the in case there is conflict with China. And I think that when we look at this, we have to see that what the U.S. is trying to do right now is not so much back up Israel, although they do stand with Israel and so forth, but to secure some kind of an agreement in regard to the Middle East, which is necessary because of the key strategic character of the region, but also to prepare for what the number one objective of U.S. foreign policy is, preparation for war with China, of U.S. military policy.
Richard Becker, actually, as Jim has pointed out in his introduction, Israel has now also demanded that Iran must not even be allowed to develop the nuclear capacity for peaceful uses. What accounts for the timing of this demand on Israel's part? And would this demand by Israel, together with the recent Houthi missile attacks, cause the negotiations between the United States and Iran to halt, or at least for now?
Well, I would have thought that maybe a couple of days ago, but with what's happened today, and if the reports are true that if Iran, the Iranian government, is promoting and standing behind a new agreement between the U.S. and Yemen, then that would suggest, at least, that Iran and the U.S. may be moving towards some kind of negotiation. The negotiations happened in Oman that led to the suspension of the U.S.-Yemeni conflict. And that's the same place where the negotiations were going on in regard to where the U.S. and Iran were meeting, was in Oman and being mediated by the Omani foreign ministry. So I think that a very definite shift that's going on here. Israel wants a war with Iran. They want to have a big war with Iran. Netanyahu wants that. But I don't think the U.S. wants that. I don't think that's what the priority of the Trump administration is at this point. It's not that they're great, they're good, any of that. It's that they have other priorities, and their top priority is preparation for conflict with China.
So, Richard, then does that mean that if war does break out, full-fledged war does break out between Iran and Israel, that the Trump administration may be reluctant to back Israel and get involved in their defense?
Well, I think there's a general consensus that Israel cannot go to war with Iran without the approval of the United States.
Right.
This is so big. That's such a big, big step to take. I mean, the whole region will be thrown into chaos by such a war. And then, aside from the huge casualties there would be and all the suffering that would be imposed on the populations, Israel cannot take the step of launching a new all-out war against Iran without the approval of Washington. There are certain things that they do on their own. Washington looks the other way or approves of them or disapproves but doesn't take any action. But this would be big. This would change the whole dynamics in the Middle East, and it could throw into question U.S. interest, that is the interest of the Pentagon and the White House. So they can't do that. They can't do it without the approval of the U.S. The Israelis cannot launch such a war. And I think that we see a lot. There's so much that comes out in things like this is that, you know, for instance, the U.S. isn't being dictated to by Israel about its foreign policy in the Middle East. That's not happening. Some people think it is, but that's a false idea. The U.S. is the biggest empire that's ever existed. It's a worldwide empire. Israel is a small country. They have separate interests. Often they have overlapping interests when Israel is doing what the empire wants. But Israel's main objective is more land. More land and crushing the Palestinian resistance. The U.S., the Trump administration, and before them Biden and Obama and every administration, they are managing a global empire. And managing a global empire requires a great deal in order to do that. And it's the priority is not the same. They have the different, really top priorities that is between Israel and the United States.
Richard, if there is an Iran-Israeli war, do you believe Israel would use its nuclear arsenal in its war with Iran?
Well, I think that would be, again, an enormous step to take. And again, I don't think that I don't think they can go to war with Iran without the approval of the U.S. And I don't think certainly they could use nuclear weapons. I mean, it would against Iran in the case of a war breaking out. I mean, that too would completely throw into chaos, I think, the whole world situation. As I said, the U.S. leaders are trying to manage an empire. They don't want things, if they can avoid them, put their legitimacy into question any more than is necessary. I mean, they'll go carry out all kinds of brutality and so forth, but they don't want to set the whole world aflame. And I think that an Israeli-Iranian war would lead in that direction.
So, Richard, then, are you of the opinion that a full-blown war between Iran and Israel is out of the question?
Well, it's not out of the question. I mean, and there could be a very adventurous, like the Netanyahu government could say, okay, we're going to do something and we'll see what the U.S. thinks. And, you know, maybe we can just, using our political influence inside the United States, get them to go along with this. But I don't really think so. I don't really think that that's what's coming right now. And the fact that this agreement that was just announced today, where Iran, if the reports are correct, encouraged the Ansar Allah government, the Houthis in Yemen, to make an agreement with the U.S., that would indicate that rather than going in the direction of a new war, that the Trump administration and its advisors is looking to have to make an agreement with Iran rather than to go to war with Iran at this point.
So, Richard, at the moment, Israel has its hands full attempting to destroy Hamas in Palestine. It is clear that Israel now intends to purge all of Gaza and the West Bank of Palestinians. Do you believe Israel can successfully do that, can eliminate Hamas to the point where Israel can take over full control and make the occupied territories part of a greater Israel, forcing the Palestinians to flee Palestine or die?
Well, that's definitely what their intention is. That's what their goal is. And the greater Israel, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, part of southern Lebanon is now under Israeli control. More of the Golan Heights and part of Syria is now occupied by the state of Israel. They want to get the population out. Here we're approaching in a week the Nakba Day, commemorating what happened in 1948, the dispossession of 750,000 Palestinians very suddenly, very quickly, with no preparation for what was going to happen, but with the determination of Israel to take as much land as possible. And they're continuing. That's what the U.S., that's what Israeli, the desire of the Israeli government, and it's been the desire of all of the Israeli governments, from the first one, David Ben-Gurion, the Labor Party back in the late 40s and early 50s to the mid-70s, or the Likud governments that have followed, including Netanyahu's, the North Star of their policy has been conquering more land, conquering more territory. And so we see them taking more territory now in Lebanon, more territory in Syria. And clearly the desire is to drive the Palestinians out of not only Gaza, where they've inflicted just indescribable destruction and misery, but of the West Bank as well. So the people, you know, I remember talking to people and they said, oh, that idea of the greater Israel, that was in the past. Well, it might not be exactly the same as it was in the 1920s or the 1930s, but the desire to create a greater state of Israel, to expand Israel's territory, that's going on. And that's the struggle that's taking place right now. And what the outcome is going to be, we don't know. But clearly, they're for inflicting starvation as well as bombs on the population in just unprecedented ways, indescribable ways, and ways that should be condemned by everyone in the world who stands for justice.
Legislation is kicking about problems on the college campuses of expelling and getting rid of students who've had dared to protest what Israel and the United States have been doing in Gaza. What do you think in this period ahead is the most effective way that those of us in this country that oppose what is happening, who oppose what Israel and the U.S. is doing in Gaza, can do in order to demonstrate or fight back against that?
Well, there's a lot to do. There's really a great deal that we can do, and we need to, given the situation, the dire character of this situation in Gaza today. But I wanted to say something about the attacks that are taking place on students and on universities all over. You know, when you see these proclamations that come from the orders that come from Trump and from elsewhere, you would think that there's no other kind of discrimination or racism or besides anti-Semitism. Only anti-Semitism is mentioned in these orders. They don't talk about, you know, anti-Black racism or anti-Latino or anti-Asian or anti-Native American. I mean, it's really amazing. It's really like all other forms of discrimination have disappeared. And one of the things that makes it even more remarkable is that in the proclamations about anti-Semitism, there are no attacks on Jewish students are cited. And I mean this around the country. I mean, there's no violent attacks that anyone has been able to record. And people have been, the people who just made the film, The Encampments, which is a great, great movie, award-winning movie that's just come out about the encampments last year, and particularly about Columbia, they've done the research. And, you know, so we have a completely false presentation. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of Jewish students, and along with others, have been beaten, have been expelled, had other kinds of punishment inflicted on them, not by the movement, but by the administration, by the police, and by the Trump administration. But we have this completely twisted, turned upside down presentation of what's happening today. This is something that the very courageous students are standing up to. They're continuing to fight. Next weekend, the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, depending on the day, there are going to be demonstrations around the country commemorating the Nakba, what happened in 1948. And, of course, connecting that with what's happening in Gaza and in the West Bank today.
Richard, we are, I'm afraid, now out of time. If people want to learn more about the ANSWER, Anti-War, Anti-Racism Coalition, how do they go about doing that? And where else might you direct people if they want more information on what we've been talking about today?
Well, there's the ANSWER Coalition, all one word, answercoalition.org. ANSWER stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. So there's answercoalition.org. And there's also, I think, a very, very important source is the People's Forum. The People's Forum, you can just search for the People's Forum. And the People's Forum, along with other organizations, are coming under attack now by the government, being named because they have courageously stood against the genocide that's taking place in Gaza and in solidarity with the Palestinian people. There's a lot of information there on many different issues. The People's Forum and the ANSWER Coalition.
Well, Richard Becker, we thank you so much for being with us today here on Law and Disorder and for your thoughts and for your references. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much, Jim and Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Two weeks ago, the Center for Constitutional Rights along with a group of four human rights organizations, together with legal clinics, published a new report urging the United Nations to denounce the accelerated disintegration of democracy in the United States. The report focuses on the U.S. government's increasing criminalization and repression of free speech, dissent, and protest under the guise of, quote, national security, close quote. The report was then submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council, which is scheduled to formally review the United States' compliance with its human rights obligations in November. It is part of the Universal Periodic Review process. We speak today with attorney Nadia Ben-Youssef, the advocacy director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She has said that, quote, our hope is that the report sounds the alarm for the international community to act with greater urgency to challenge this administration and its belligerent efforts to dismantle constitutional protections and international law, close quote. Attorney Nadia Ben-Youssef directs the CCR's advocacy around issues related to the protection of civil and human rights. She has expertise in international human rights fora and mechanisms and experience in developing advocacy strategies to influence U.S. decision makers. She's a member of the New York State Bar. Attorney Nadia Ben-Youssef, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you, Jim. It's great to be here.
Nadia, you've written that, quote, the human rights violations described in the report make clear that the U.S. is an authoritarian political reality where the Trump administration, Congress, and state governments have fully suspended international human rights and are engaging in tactics of repression that are hallmarks of a fascist regime, end quote. We want to speak with you today about these tactics of oppression and repression. Could you please tell us about President Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act? Who is he using it against, and what are they trying to do to these people?
Right. We're seeing really, really extreme measures. And I think the Alien Enemies Act, the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 is a really great and troubling of what we mean by this authoritarian political reality. So the Alien Enemies Act, you know, we're talking an 18th century wartime law. And this is actually the first time that it is being invoked outside of a context of a declared law, declared war, sorry. So President Trump, so this was, has been invoked three times in history, the War of 1812, World War I, World War II. And the Alien Enemies Act is really concerned about, you know, who is and who is not American, who is and who is not a threat to national security. And when Trump is invoking it, you know, he's using this sort of pretext and declaration of a, quote, you know, invasion at the southern border to designate an entire community as a national security threat, as an alien enemies. And we're talking about Venezuelans, particularly having designated the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua as a foreign terrorist organization. So you're going to hear a lot over the course of this interview about this framework, the terrorism framework, national security framework, and how that's being weaponized against vulnerable communities. So with the Alien Enemies Act invocation, the declaration of Tren de Aragua as a foreign terrorist organization, what the Trump administration is able to do is sort of summarily deport anyone with purported ties to this gang. You know, and some of these affiliations are based on tattoos, which are, you know, of course, not a reliable indica of involvement, and obviously a racialized sort of characterization of affiliation that we've seen in other contexts too, using this wartime authority to suspend, you know, any semblance of human rights or civil rights for huge communities of people. And so what has happened is that a particular piece that I want to highlight that we just touched on in this report, but, you know, we're getting more and more information about, obviously, which is the transfer of Venezuelans and others to El Salvador under this $6 million agreement between the U.S. government and the El Salvadoran government to imprison people in this notorious, brutal terrorism confinement center, or CECUT, in blatant violation of international human rights obligations, of course. But they're currently imprisoning approximately 260 people. 238 of those are from Venezuela. CCR is representing one person held at CECUT. And, you know, just warehousing my immigrants in these maximum security prisons, which of course sounds like Guantanamo, right? It sounds like the disappearance and detention of people in offshore prisons without due process, without access to courts, to law, really full suspension of human rights. But it feels, what I think is important is that this infrastructure and ideology, you know, of national security, quote unquote, of terrorism, quote unquote, was laid well before this administration. But the Trump administration is sort of supercharging, escalating, weaponizing, you know, U.S. impunity for these kinds of tactics and torture regimes in the past, and then just recycling, replicating, expanding at a really, really terrifying rate.
You know, Nadia, the report that you're discussing documents as well the government's repeated and rising number of attacks on civil society as well as on lawyers. Could you describe what the government is doing in these respects?
Totally. Yeah, great question, Jim. And I think that's, as it's escalating its attacks on the most vulnerable, marginalized communities, it's also targeting the infrastructure of support, you know, legal support, civil society, right? And I think the Trump administration has issued executive orders, directives that attack the funding of NGOs, particularly and exclusively those NGOs that don't align with this administration's really regressive ideological stances. So right when Trump took office for a second time, you saw a memo from the Office of Management and Budget that issued a funding freeze on federal spending on grants. And I kind of want to quote this because it's so outrageous, but it's saying, you know, the use of federal resources, I'm quoting, to advance Marxist equity, transgenderism, and Green New Deal social engineering policies is a waste of taxpayer dollars that does not improve the day-to-day lives of those we serve. And so that memo really set the stage for the targeting of civil society through funding. So then you, of course, saw the federal funding freezes impacting humanitarian aid organizations, so shuttering USAID, warning others not to speak out. And, you know, humanitarian organizations, we're talking about Save the Children, Mercy Corps. And again, it's really trying to make it so that the most vulnerable among us don't have access to the necessary support that they need, whether that's legal support, material support. You also saw in the last couple of months, and it's really just been such a whirlwind, but broad attacks on lawyers and legal infrastructure, executive orders targeting law firms, which led to the really shameful capitulation of many in big law to the demands and the priorities of the Trump administration. And these attacks were also at play in the administration targeting a civil rights clinic at Northwestern Law School, which CCR was involved in, where the House Education and Workforce Committee was making, you know, these unconstitutional demands of five colleges and universities to turn over information, their names of donors, student information. And this was largely, for in the case of Northwestern, connected to the clinic's representation of activists who were protesting U.S. complicity in Israel's genocide in Palestine. And that kind of ties to a big theme, of course, of this administration, which is to silence and suppress the movement for Palestine. And again, that's going after every layer, civil society, lawyers, anyone who might also be lending their support to that fight.
Nadia, please talk about the illogical targeting of student activists protesting Israel's genocide of Palestinians. Why is this illogical?
It's a great question. Right. I mean, I think we're operating beyond the bounds of logic or rationality when it comes to fascist repression. And so it's hard to describe it as anything but illogical and unfounded and repressive at its core, right? It is trying to silence, in the way that authoritarians do, movements for freedom and for justice that are challenging the status quo, that are challenging states and circumstances of supremacy, of human hierarchy. And since October of 2023, you know, thousands of students, faculty, community members have faced arrest, suspension, surveillance, employment consequences for participating in protests against U.S. complicity in Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza, which is ongoing now. Universities summoned state, local, and campus police to crack down on students. You know, you had over 3,000 arrests on more than 80 campuses in the spring of 2024 alone. That repression has escalated dramatically in the last 2 months. Of course, we saw in March the abduction of Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia graduate student, and then successive attempts to deport and disappear student activists, particularly targeting immigrant students, international students. And, you know, part of it is the strength of the movement, the undeniable righteousness of this movement to stop U.S. complicity and the complicity of institutions like universities in Israel's genocide. And the government at all levels, at the federal level, at state and local level, and then even in these sort of microcosms of governance, which is on these institutions, are using every tool that they have to try to silence this unsilenceable movement. And there are a huge amount of tools that these decision makers, lawmakers, and the powerful can use. And we're seeing them use the most cowardly weapons, you know, disappearing people and suspending, revoking visas and trying to make it so that this issue is radioactive. It's trying to silence support. I think it's important to note that the abduction of Mahmoud Khalil happened at the same time that the ceasefire ended and that Israel recommitted to its genocidal campaign in Palestine. And so that repression and the focus of trying to protect these people who were being abducted off the streets, you know, and to also chill a movement for Palestine in the United States was happening at the same time that the violence in Palestine was heightening. So I think we must stay focused on the why is this happening? Why is the U.S. government really so committed to silencing this movement and using whatever means they can, particularly to target activists?
Yes. And also, just changing focus just a little bit, but domestic terrorism charges have been filed against the group Stop Cop City protesters in Georgia. Explain to our listeners what Cop City is and what is it the government has done in going after them for domestic terrorism, and what do they claim the protesters have done that constitutes domestic terrorism?
You know, I think what you're pointing to, too, is just how nebulous this framework is and how easy it is for the powerful to use it to stifle dissent and advocacy on anything that they don't like, right? So Stop Cop City, and I want to maybe pause here to say that this report was a collective effort. And so we have partners in Georgia and elsewhere, so Sierra Club of Georgia and the University of Dayton Human Rights Center that really focused on this section of the report and have experience sort of doing work with activists and particularly those who have been charged, as you said, with domestic terrorism. So Stop Cop City, massive militarized police training facility in Atlanta. And the Stop Cop City movement was a national and even international effort to stop the development of this massive training facility in a forest in Atlanta. And we saw some of the most egregious, brutal tactics of repression to stop protesters from advocating against the construction of this facility, including the first killing of an environmental human rights defender in U.S. history, Manuel Esteban Paez Terán, who was known as Tortuguita, was killed for protesting peacefully in this forest against Stop Cop City and against Cop City. And so really brutal tactics, including what you asked, Jim, which is this domestic terrorism and also a RICO indictment. So in September of 2023, Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr announced the prosecution of 61 people in an indictment under Georgia's RICO statute. So RICO is the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. This is like, you know, coming from the mob and criminal conspiracies, etc. And this indictment says that belief in the opposition to Cop City constitutes a criminal enterprise. So like people who believe that Cop City shouldn't exist, that belief is sufficient to say that there's sort of a criminal conspiracy happening. The prosecution really starts, you know, maligning all sorts of tactics, organizing tactics, mutual aid, direct action, protest as domestic terrorism. And so you start seeing, I think, in that example, just why it's so important that there's, and so useful to the government, that there's no, you know, definition of terrorism in U.S. law, that it is something that can be used and weaponized against movements for justice. And we should all be really concerned about that, about how the terrorism charges can be levied against our people and our activists, our students, our organizers who are providing, you know, whether it's life-saving sort of mutual aid or challenging construction of prisons and pushing back on state violence in all of its forms.
Nadia, immigrants have been illegally surveyed. How extensive is this surveillance?
Yes, you know, this is a troubling part of the report as well that I hope readers can focus on, led by Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology and the International Justice Clinic at UC Irvine School of Law. They really did a deep dive into how intrusive and disproportionate and the surveillance is and that the U.S. government is engaged in with little to no transparency and oversight. I mean, it's really wild. Like we're talking about, you know, sweeping law enforcement-wide database of DNA that the Department of Homeland Security created in 2020, or ICE having a sprawling infrastructure of sensitive data from hundreds of public and private sources on geolocation data, home addresses, new social media monitoring tools. So AI like features prominently in this report, but really, Department of Homeland Security and ICE are violating the rights of privacy to people, of the right to privacy of people in the United States. And it really is to get as much data as possible and create a surveillance infrastructure that these agencies can use to carry out any goal that they might have. Again, you know, with DNA data, with home addresses, with, you know, social media kind of targeting, like, who's speaking out against what? What are your interests in? Where are you? And then also, this is sort of a troubling development recently, which is that in September of 2024, DHS, again, the Department of Homeland Security, entered into a $2 million contract with Paragon Solutions. So this is an Israeli-headquartered spyware software. And spyware is terrifying, super invasive, access to any data or accessible by a target device. So this includes encrypted messages, Signal, this is a huge sort of infrastructure that the U.S. government is using. It's also just how the law, which, you know, this is a show on Law and Disorder. It's not the law could permit such surveillance. You know, you have Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And we wrote a bit about this, too, which permits intelligence agencies to spy on foreign individuals without a warrant or any court review. So you have the infrastructure, you have the law, the unjust laws that allow these agencies to do to do this level of surveillance, and it's extensive, and it really is, you know, it's being tested on the most vulnerable. So this is immigrants, people of color, of course, always.
This report that we've been discussing, Nadia, it does include some specific recommendations for each of the violations it cites. I wonder, could you perhaps talk to us about some of these recommendations?
Definitely. So this is part of the Universal Periodic Review process, as Michael shared at the beginning. And the U.S. is being reviewed in November by all the other member states of the United Nations about its human rights compliance on every issue, right? So it's a periodic process that happens every 4.5 or 5 years. We're thinking that, in fact, the government may not participate. They've sort of indicated as such. Their report is due in July, and it's unclear and maybe unlikely that they'll participate. And so, you know, part of the recommendations is asking other member states to inquire, to raise concern about the human rights violations that we outline in the report in their sort of interventions to the United States. It was hard to write those recommendations, in part because we know we're dealing with an administration that has no interest in complying with international law or with human rights. In fact, is doing everything to suspend that sort of post-World War II international legal framework. And so what does it mean to ask for, you know, specific recommendations of this administration or any U.S. administration? But this one was particularly difficult. But, right, I mean, we're asking for, you know, a whole of government review of its counterterrorism policies, frankly, I mean, that are used and weaponized against protesters, against people of color. We ask for suspension, you know, for the end to Section 702 of FISA, of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Like that, we should get rid of that. I mean, some of it is like specific weapons of the government that are being used against our people, and calling attention to that and hoping that member states will call the United States on its obligations. And essentially we're saying, you know, all of this is in violation of human rights, in violation of the U.S.'s obligations, and that should be a concern to member states around the world, particularly because the degradation and the erosion of international law at that level really has a ripple effect and a snowball effect, and we're seeing it being played out around the world. So I think it's kind of, the recommendations themselves will be great if member states raise them. But I think in this context of an authoritarian regime of sort of rising fascism, it's less important that individual recommendations are followed and more that the international community really wakes up to the situation that we're in and really the catastrophic situation for human rights and particularly for vulnerable people.
Nadia, if I'm not prying, could you please tell us how you got to be political, what your background is, very briefly?
Oh my goodness, yeah. You know, I am the granddaughter of refugees and revolutionaries, and I think that history ties me to the struggle of the oppressed always. So it's sort of a living legacy. But I, you know, my political journey is complicated by also being the daughter of immigrants and what it means to try to protect oneself and one's family in this country. And part of it is adopting this idea of a social justice that is not as political as it should be. And so I think I was politicized over time. Kind of, I think the clearest moment of my politicization was in Palestine. I went to Palestine right after law school to work at a Palestinian human rights organization called Adala. Palestine is such a threat to this world order because it lays bare the injustices, it lays bare the hypocrisies and the incompatibilities of human rights when you have a situation, an ongoing situation of colonization, ethnic cleansing, and genocide happening. And so really a lot of clarity about structures and systems of oppression while I was in Palestine, and then coming back to the United States to do advocacy on Palestine and connecting to other movements I think has really clarified also the power of solidarity. And that harkens back to, you know, a legacy too. So my grandfather was a revolutionary in the Tunisians' independence movement against France. And his politicization really was around third world solidarity and the power of the multitude to combat empire and to challenge a world order that was premised on human hierarchy. And so part of my work and my journey, I think, is also to honor that legacy and to reach back to it and to insist upon it, that there's a wisdom in and a power of solidarity as we try to change the shape of the world. And so, yeah, I'm indebted to the movements before me, for sure, and that you both are a part of course, too, and so grateful to be at the Center for Constitutional Rights, an organization that has a lot of political coherence over time, over the last 60 years of showing up for people who are struggling for freedom and for justice in a really unjust world.
Well, Nadia, we are sadly now out of time, but I wonder, before we have to let you go, how can our listeners get a copy of this report? How can they follow the work at the Center for Constitutional Rights?
Thanks for that. Yes, please go to our website. The report is there under, yeah, the Universal Periodic Review sort of section of our website. You can find it. It's called Entrenching Authoritarianism. And you can follow CCR. You can sign up to our newsletter. CCR is on all sort of social media, Instagram, X, Blue Sky. And I hope that you do follow us. And, you know, we're in this together. It's a really difficult time, an almost impossible time. But I think that when the people struggle, you know, there's victory there and there's power there.
What's your website, Nadia?
Thanks, Michael. CCRjustice.org.
Nadia Ben Youssef, a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much. Every success in your work. You be well.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.